20 in Belarus, as this is one of the things that shaped the political atmosphere in Belarus in our current kind of a reality, right? What happened back then was that, as you might have remembered, 2020 was the beginning of the COVID wave. In Belarus, our great leader Lukashenko said there is no COVID, and if you get the COVID, you can fix it with vodka and tractor driving. He literally said that. A lot of people felt left alone by the government. When you would go to the hospital, your medical, how would you call it? Like medical diagnosis would be just a pneumonia and so on and so forth. So big chunks of the society were left on their own in those times. And people found themselves in the situation where they have to organize. I think many of you in Europe know about the solidarity networks that you had in your countries that were quite small. In Belarus, those were like the matter of basic survival, right? People had to get together to survive COVID because the state ignores it and kind of like even pushes back to say there is no COVID. And as a result of that, there were a lot of social networks formed up around organizing against COVID in Belarus, social networks that were also full of anger and dissatisfaction with the Belarusian government, with Lukashenko's government that was there for the last 25 years already. And at that point, when this anger and this dissatisfaction was happening, Belarusian government announced that there will be election that year. A lot of that dissatisfaction from social and medical problems transformed also into political dissatisfaction. A lot of people who were involved in self-organizing on the streets against COVID started organizing politically against Lukashenko's run in the presidency. There were a bunch of different candidates, and most of those candidates within 1 month of the presidential campaign were arrested and ended up in prison under like false charges. But there was one person who ended up running. It was a woman. And for Lukashenko, whose government is very like, masculine, macho style, they thought, okay, what women can do to our great dictatorship? And they failed in this miserably because a lot of people got rallied around this woman, not specifically for her as a candidacy for presidency, but rather as a person who will get into the presidency and will get proper elections happening in the country. So that was happening in the summer, right? People were rallying. There were some registered demonstrations, demonstrations, but also rallies around this, around the country where people would meet and talk about politics. And by the day of the elections, the mobilization was happening already all around the country. And this was like the biggest mobilization I can remember being politically active, where people would call to go to the streets on very small cities. And on the day of elections, the protests happened all around the country. Minsk is the capital, had like one of the biggest protests, but in the smaller towns, because of a small presence of the police in some places, people could even take over the town, right? Like just completely smash the police forces and take it over and go back to home, not expecting that the cops will come back. And that's what was happening for the first 3 days. So people would go to the streets and they would be prepared for, some of them at least, would be prepared for aggressive confrontation with the state. There would be clashes happening in Minsk, in Brest, in Grodno, in many different places with not only stones but some other things like barricades, Molotov cocktails used first time in my kind of like political history again in my head. So there was a lot of things happening, and as a result of that, there was this feeling created that, fucking hell, we are winning. Like the images of the running cops away from the demonstrators was something so empowering that everybody were like, woohoo, the dictatorship is going down, right? But at the same time, there was a lot of repressions happening en masse. In the first 3 days, there were over 6,000 people arrested. That went to different prisons that were like overcrowded, and you would have cells like where people would be standing. It would be like the cells would be so packed that people would be standing for 12, 24 hours waiting for the trial to get processed. And there was a lot of like physical violence as well happening. You would have people beaten up on the streets, but also people who were beaten up on the streets then brought to the police stations, to the like gyms in the police stations, beaten up there. Then they would be transferred to the prison, beaten up there as well. The violence just basically spilled over. And quite often the violence was like a revenge violence. So the cops would arrest you, and it's not like you're heavily resisting, but rather like they experienced their violence. They got beaten up, so they start beating people up. And there were like even categorizations of the people. People had like red cross on the t-shirt or yellow cross on the t-shirt, and that like defined how much violence will be used against those people. So as a result of that, of these 3 days of escalation on the streets and clashes on the streets, a lot of people ended up in prison, and some people came up with this idea, hey, we have to de-escalate here, we have to make it like peaceful and nice and go to the streets as with the slogans to stop the violence from the police side. And it kind of worked, because for the police it was also very important to de-escalate, because they were losing control completely all over the country, right? And this de-escalation gave them the possibility for regrouping, reassessing the strategy, because the Belarusian riot police is not like very trained in riots, very trained in crowd control. So it took them actually quite some time to rearrange the repressions. And in that time, when the de-escalation happened, for several months, people were going to the streets and protesting. People were going on the demonstrations that would be peaceful marches all around the country. One of them, the biggest one, was around 300,000-400,000 people in Minsk. And Minsk is like 2 million people, so you have one-fourth of the population that is on the streets. Although a lot of people came from other cities for sure, but Belarus is also a country of 9.5 million people, so it's a lot of people on the streets who are protesting against Lukashenko. And those marches continued every Sunday for the next 3 months, and they transformed from this, we are destroying the dictatorship, into a certain celebration of the destruction of dictatorship. There was a lot of analysis brought into the Belarusian society that Lukashenko is not going to survive this wave of protests, this wave of riots and so on. So a lot of people were already celebrating the victory. You would have a lot of people on the streets, you know, like very happy and not really, looking forward into how can we bring the dictatorship down. But there were also different groups who were organizing during those protests. There were, apart from these bigger marches, there were women marches that made like a, let's say, feminist Belarusian movement very strong. And in general, women presence in those protests, like very, very serious, with certain situations where women were giving examples to the men how to actually fight back the dictatorship. And that created a very important atmosphere in Belarusian society, where right now this division, you know, of masculinity is somehow broken, and a lot of women are playing a very important role in the political struggle. There were also marches of students. Some students were trying to occupy universities, which didn't work out that well. So there were a lot of social groups mobilized to those protests. You would have from this, the kids in the schools up to the retired people, also from different economical classes, from the working class up to the upper middle class or upper classes that have money, that were interested in removing Lukashenko away. We also had a workers' movement that kind of like woke up after first days of riots, as a lot of violence spilled on the streets. A lot of workers didn't show up at work, so your colleagues are not coming. They are arrested for 15 days, and this provokes organizing of the workers. There was a wave of strikes all around Belarus with a lot of different factories striking. And there was even like a video, maybe you've been following those, there was a video where Lukashenko came as this kind of like a serious dictator to the factory. And at that factory, they were shouting at him, go away, go away. And he was trying to give a speech, and they were shouting all the time, go away. This gives like, this shows how brave the workers at that factory were, because normally like you would lose a job for that. Minimum, right? Maximum, you could go like to prison for such things very easily on falsified charges, right? So, and then there were also people who were disappointed in these peaceful marches, or they were participating in peaceful marches, but they would go also in the mode of direct action. So they would form up smaller groups and they would attack police cars or attack like judges' cars and so on and so forth. And burn them down. And this was also a very new thing in Belarus. And when I'm talking about that, it's not anarchists who were like en masse organizing and burning the infrastructure of the state, though some anarchists were doing that. It was actually like also simple people who were like, we have to do something right now. And how do we do that? And they were getting together on Telegram, organizing those actions. Of course, for police, it was easy to infiltrate those groups, so parts of the groups fell apart or got like prison sentences for a police informer inside of those groups of like a simple workers who would just take like, you know, a match and a gasoline and go and try to burn down like a house of some officials. Yeah. As for other types of organizing, what happened was that a lot of those groups, as I was talking about, the groups that were built around COVID, they also got to know each other in the neighborhoods. And when the protests started, like, let's say, going slower, a lot of people started organizing in the neighborhoods. So you would have like Sunday marches, but during the Sunday marches, or after the Sunday marches, people would get together in the neighborhoods, organize social events, organize political events, which was like very new to Belarus. In general, in Belarus, you do not interact with your neighbors, but this kind of like broke the ice, and we had like very big groups. As in some neighborhoods, you would have hundreds and hundreds of people who would go to Sunday marches in organized groups from their neighborhoods to stick together to keep that like collective safety. And that was also an amazing example of kind of decentralization of the protest power, so to say, because neighborhood assemblies started seeing themselves not as we are just like doing concerts or doing some political events, but rather like units of political struggle. And in the better future where Lukashenko loses, there was a hope that those neighborhood assemblies could become a very important power of direct democracy, of direct participation in the political struggle. Yeah. So. At the end of the day, the Belarusian state was adapting during those months of the protests. People were going and, you know, waving their flags, while the police was actually suppressing the protests in smaller towns. Then they went to the bigger towns, while Minsk was like, "Woohoo, we are still winning." People in the smaller cities were already like sitting in jail or left their homes to go to political exile. And at the end of the day, they came to Minsk. And in the Minsk protests were also smashed pretty much by direct violence, also arrests, not given possibility for people to gather, and so on and so forth. Consequences. You want to go for the consequences? I'm fucking tired.
Okay, I will talk about the consequences of that. And if you click. Thanks. So first of all, here you can see the number. I think we have not changed it recently because a few more prisoners have died in jail from the time that we put this picture. So when we speak about victims, it's not only people who were like shot immediately in the street actions, but also people who would be found in the forest kind of committing suicide during the days of the protests, or just disappeared and never been found, or people who would be put in jails for short arrests and then get COVID there and then get out and die 2 weeks later. So we, because they were not provided with any healthcare. And also, I think until now, it's been two or three, I'm confused, political prisoners who died in prison under either because they were not provided medical care on time or they committed suicide, which is weird. Then this number is also, it's like 2,000 plus political prisoners. Why are we saying that? Because clearly not all the people are reporting their repressions, right? So this is the number that you can find of the people who went publicly about the repression against their family member, or that the person reported themselves, or sometimes because people are not reporting it, cops are publishing who they detained, and this is the only way right now to actually identify how much is the mess, the scale of repression is going on. So that's basically, I would say it's like, for me, it's about 4,000, and you should understand that it's been 3 years after this uprising, and we still have at least 90 trials every month, like related to that. So it's like, it's not stopping. People, they started like looking through footage and using the face recognition systems to just identify fucking everyone. So it's not that you can like just forget, delete Instagram picture and like live your life. This means that you're, if you're in Belarus, if you participated in one of that actions and if you were like caught by the media on a picture, most probably at some point they will knock your door. Nothing changed? Okay, let me, yeah. Is this the, yeah? All right, so we had some independent media, like which were like supported mostly by the West and living on grants and stuff like that, but all of them are now shut down, so there is not really any media outlet that even sometimes like a business media outlets, they were also shut down just because they supported the protests or like covered the protest extensively. And not only that, but also the all the media who were like, for example, whose websites were blocked in the country, they moved to the social media, to Telegram channels or Instagram and stuff like that. And in order to avoid people to consume their information, the government announces or declares them extremist formations. And an extremist formation is not an organization, it's like anything and everyone who is interacting with the content. So either you're creating it, or you're sharing it, or you're commenting on it, you're giving it a like, or you're even sending it in a private chat, like I read this news, check it out. And so if you're then arrested, cops are checking your private chats, they see you like transferring, and you get like at least 15 days in prison, and sometimes more, because this is considered to be facilitation of extremist activity. NGOs, we had some NGOs that actually, I think, not that we are like very much supportive of the NGO activism, but I think that before the protest, different human rights defenders and environmental NGOs, like all kinds of like feminist NGOs and LGBT and stuff like that, they did a lot of work on like actually raising the issues in the society. And because they were like peaceful and nonviolent, they were let to do so. So while anarchists have experienced like repression more or less the same scale for years, like decades, these people were like could operate, and also they could influence by this way, by organizing public campaigns, other people. Plus they had their spaces, so people could come and talk, could organize, like could join a discussion. Like nothing like that is possible in Belarus, for you to understand, like we couldn't like talk about this in Belarus. So it was important that these places were there, but because they were shut down, it's like there's no political space anymore where people could like meet up. Okay. And also the same happened to the bars, bookshops, and everybody who supported the protest in any way. So many bars were like either trying to shield the activists, the protesters who were like running away, or they were putting some posters, they were like shutting down as a solidarity sign, as a kind of a national strike attempt or something like that. And then they later were like either financially persecuted, so they were given a lot of fines for like not acting according to guidelines, according to sanitary norms and stuff like that, or their heads, their managers were just arrested and like or expelled from the country. So that basically means that right now there is not so much, like there's nothing where you can like go and hang out with like-minded people. There's only like just kind of apolitical bars, and that are afraid actually to do anything against the regime, because the next day they will be shut down. And a few words about what kind of legislation the state has introduced, because it looks like the state was really scared, like even though we before that, for example, we had death penalty and like all kinds of articles that could be used against, for example, anarchist or anti-fascist for political persecution, like arson, destruction of property and stuff like that. But they decided to like even toughen it even more, because it was kind of on a massive scale used by the people. And the examples would be, For example, they expanded the law on extremism that existed since 2008, but this law was like very vague and it only concerned, for example, extremist leaflets, or like our brochures would be extremists, so we cannot like give them out in the street, or people cannot store them at home, or for example, our website has been extremist for like a lot of years already. But now what they started doing, they started like applying the extremist law to anyone who's participated in the protest or read the media that is now extremist, or shared something, or sent pictures to the media, like to report and use something like that. So right now, everybody can be announced a participant in an extremist formation just for like interacting with somebody who is officially extremist. Also, the criminalization of solidarity happened because many funds have been installed or launched for supporting political prisoners or for supporting workers that have been dismissed. Like many strike kind of casas and stuff like this have been like people who would donate to these causes are now being persecuted based on, for example, many of them were organized by like Facebook donation thing, you know? And so nowadays they are like checking the banks of everyone or like everyone they want and seeing if you like made a transfer to Facebook, they come to you, like they force you to open like your Facebook, or like they just torture you and you tell, yes, I donated to that. So there's like people are afraid to donate, and this is why also it's important for us, because we are surviving on donations, that we can support our prisoners only like based on the money that we get. And right now in Belarus, or from Belarus, since it's not possible like to get any support because we are like also extremist, an extremist organization. And also a lot of people, because sanctions were imposed by the West on Belarus to kind of pressure the regime and demanding the release of political prisoners and also like new elections and new kind of democratic changes and stuff. And so a lot of people have been calling for that. So actually, unlike the widespread opinion that I hear sometimes in Europe, where people are saying that you shouldn't impose sanctions because it's like poor people in Belarus who are suffering, a lot of poor people in Belarus are actually calling for these sanctions because they want to have it as much harder for the regime, as less money going inside the budget, and then it will probably like spill into another protest or spill into another like public unrest. So many people are persecuted for that. Then also, like I said, there is death penalty, but now they have increased it for attempted terrorist attacks. And it's not even that something that you would do, but maybe you think about it, you talk to your friends about it. And this was related to the post-war sabotage actions at the railway tracks, where people tried to like destroy the computer equipment that regulates the signal systems of the train, and several people were like detained in groups even before like coming there, and then they were like accused of an attempted terrorist attack, and they can like death penalty can be used against them right now. So this has been made to like actually like stop, because at least 20 different groups in the first weeks started doing that, started destroying the tracks. So it looks like the state was really like confused and thought they need to like increase the stakes as much as possible. So it's not that you're going to jail for 20 years anymore, it's like you're dying, literally.
All right. So, talking about repressions, you've heard already a bunch of things about repressions in Belarus. But the thing is that before 2020, Belarusian state was applying repressions to maybe thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who were participating in like political opposition to the regime. I wouldn't say tens of thousands, thousands of people. But then in 2020, the amounts grew so much that the regime had to adapt and bring up new tactics to smash the popular movement. And those were maybe before practice on like a very small scale, but then turned to a very violent ways. The first thing was new, actually. And what was happening is if you get detained during the protests or you get detained after the protest for participation in movement, the police would bring you to the police station and would try to film a video with you where you repent your political ideas, where you say regime is great, Lukashenko is the best, and shit like that. So a little bit like ISIS torture videos, whatever. And if the people are not agreeing with that, so they can get tortured. And quite a lot of people got tortured to get those videos done. And you can see in those videos that people are beaten up and they have bruises and so on and so forth. And that was happening en masse, and it's still happening. What Belarusian regime was doing with those videos was that they would take them, put them on their own social networks. Like they had Telegram channels, they had YouTube channel even where they were putting those videos. And with that, they were sending message to the general like protester crowd that, look, all of you are fucking weak and we can break you, doesn't matter who you are. But also they were using those videos on the public state TV. So this was transmitted also to the crowds of people who get information only from the state TV. And it was also a message to those people saying, look, everything is under control, don't panic. We are like already breaking them and the movement is dying out. Yeah, and those videos were like thousands of them. At the end of the day, most of the platforms actually blocked their channels. Both Telegram and YouTube completely deleted all of that, so there is not so much of an archive. But this was happening very big, very en masse. And this was happening also to, for example, anarchists. And as an anarchist activist in Belarus, if you're detained, you would expect being tortured normally. Like this became a norm after 2020. Before 2020, police would use torture in some like different cases, but this was not happening en masse against the movement. This was not happening en masse against the people. So the torture against the population also like basically spilled over the border. For the police, it became a green card to torture anybody they want, basically. And as I was mentioning before, there was a lot of violence towards the protesters that were detained in the first days. A lot of that was like in the forms of torture, and some people were even killed during those torture sessions or whatever shit you call that, who were like in the police station or in the prison. So they get killed, and then the police would bring them out of the police station or out of the prison into the forest and say, oh, this was a suicide. So the person is bruised, the person is kind of destroyed, and the cops would say, no, he didn't die in our custody, he died like because he committed a suicide. Yeah, and another part was that kind of like was breaking a bit of spirit or making like people also angry was that in the first days when people were arrested and brought to the police station or to the prison, there was at least one prison in Minsk where the parents were or relatives and friends were queuing up to figure out if their friends are in that prison. Belarusian state normally does not release information that you are detained. So everybody were trying to figure out the thousands and thousands of people who were detained in first days. They were trying to figure out where are they. And they could hear like day and night, just people screaming inside of the prison, being tortured the whole time. Yeah. And this is on the picture, you can see our comrade, Mykola Dedok, who was also like tortured for several hours into submission. Then they made a video to send a message, oh, look, you have like this strong anarchist personality, we will break him for sure, and try to spread this message of terror around the whole anarchist movement, but also around the whole population. And in general, like, just to understand, with that tactic, even before the 2020, Belarusian state was like using terror tactic against the population. It's not like running its own, you know, political setup in a popular movement, but rather like it's a dictatorship that runs through terrorizing the population into fear and submission. Also, a lot of people who left the country, and there are like hundreds of thousands of Belarusians who left, many of them continue to be politically active. And for Belarusian regime, it is hard to grasp those people. So they would have like, let's say, applying collective punishment or group punishment, and they would try to repress your relatives, try to repress your parents. Some of the parents of the anarchists were also repressed. This is an example of one of the anarchists whose house was raided, and mother was like later on sentenced to 3 years of home confinement.
for participation in the process officially, but like in reality, she was targeted because she was a mother of an anarchist who was active outside of the country. Yeah. Then the other part that is becoming more and more complicated, Belarusian state was prosecuting lawyers or leaving, denying their license for some time already, but since 2020, it became also like a mass action. So we've seen in the last, I think, 1 year and a half, 2 years, 15 lawyers that we were working with lost their licenses, and this is only like our, so to say, pool. That means like amount of lawyers who are losing the possibility to protect the people in prisons is just shrinking and shrinking. And those who are staying are becoming very frightened to communicate in any way politically. And for example, this lawyer, he got detained. And one of the like demonizing features that police was using in the open was the signal channel that he had with ABC Belarus communication saying, look, he's communicating with extremists. He's passing the information that shouldn't be passed. So he will be prosecuted for that shit. Yeah. Situations in prisons. Let's fucking go. I mean, here it's important to understand that Belarusian prisons are not prisons that you know from the popular culture of your country, right? Belarusian prisons are not the prisons of Belarus or France. They're very different. And maybe if you read some, let's say, prison literature from the Soviet Union, those are prisons that inherited that type of repressions. Those prisons are built up to destroy the human spirit, to break the person mentally and also physically, and that's what fucking Belarusian prison is. It is a network of prison camps, which like you might heard in popular culture, Gulag, right? It's not Gulag, but it's still like prison camps where people live in big barracks, they go to work, or sometimes they are isolated and they can't go to work. And yeah, there are also like other prison houses where people sit in the cells, but this is uncommon. This is like very few people go there who are more problematic from the perspective of the prison administration. Many anarchists ended up in those prisons. And in general, like there is a lot of violence. There is a lot of prison internal hierarchies that would be used also against political prisoners to put pressure on them from the prison administration, but also from the prison population. And of course, as a political prisoner, not only anarchist, but also like the prisoner of the protest, the Belarusian state is not going to leave you alone when you're going to prison. There is a lot of pressure going on the people on the daily basis. People are, though they are in prison, they're still struggling. The struggle continues on every day against the state, against the prison administration. We have, I think most of the anarchist prisoners that are right now in Belarusian prisons do not have any possibility of communication with the outside apart from their relatives and maybe visitations. So if you send a letter or a postcard to the comrades, they are not going to get those. Those postcards are normally just, you know, discarded by default, or the prison administration would call the people and say, look, you have all these letters coming in, you're not getting any of them, and they just destroy them in front of those people. So that's what happens, and we kind of encourage people to use the online form that we have on our website, where we do like certain types of magic, and we pass the messages to the people. Not all the messages getting passed, but some, and you have a bigger chance that your message of support to our comrades will get there. Yeah, so you can get that on our website. And the other part is, wait. And the other part is that in Belarusian prisons, no, the other way. Have you ever visited a friend in the prison? Raise your hand. Or not a friend. Wow, that's a lot of people. An enemy. No, no enemies. That's a lot of people, and you are fucking awesome, right? In Belarus, the visitations are actually not possible from friends, not possible from third parties. The visitations are only happening from the family members, so very close family members, like mother, father, husband, wife, and that's it. And those visitations are happening very rarely. So you have normally like four times per year where the person can come and visit you for a longer period of time. And this is like a very important you know, bridge to the outside reality, taking account that you already can't write and so on and so forth. And those visitations are quite often taken away from the political prisoners as part of putting more pressure on them or trying to make them cooperate, like, you do this and we give you a visitation and shit like that. So this is happening. And on top of that, the amount of stuff you can pass to Belarusian prisons, like food parcels or care packages that people send to prisons, is also limited. And you can send those like 3-4 times a year. Which are very essential to survival inside of the prison. The food in prison is shit. The medical conditions is you get aspirin. It doesn't matter what hurts. And if you have like more problems, it takes weeks to get like an appointment with a doctor, or they bring you to the hospital only when it's like you are already fucked and you are already like on the edge of dying. They're like, oh, we need to take care of that person. But normally, like the medical conditions are actually ignored in Belarusian prisons. Yeah. One second. So apart from those prison camps I was talking, I said that there are these prison houses in Belarus. Those prison houses is what you learn from the prison culture and of like popular prison culture. So there is a cell, and inside of the cell you have maybe 2, 3, 5 people sitting 23 hours per day, and then they have 1 hour of walk. And those are like high security prisons. So there are extra conditions applied to those who are in those prisons. You get a daily check and so on and so forth. And they are used for those who are like top targets of the prison administration inside of the prisons. And the general tendency right now is actually to move more and more anarchists there, and also move in, more and more of like top political targets of the regime to the this high security prisons. And in, if you are like a person who is still not breaking in those conditions, there is also a solitary confinement, both in the prison camp and in the Belarusian prison houses. The solitary confinement is also something we inherited from the Soviet times. It didn't like progress so much. It's a cell that has like here you see like on the walls, it's called fur coat. So it's just like a concrete cell. There is no heating in many of them, so in winter it gets super fucking cold. And one of our comrades, for example, was describing his winter time in solitary confinement in the way that he would sleep for maybe 20 minutes, and then he'd do a workout for 30 minutes to warm up the body, and then sleep again for like 15 minutes. So basically the only reason those people are not dying from cold is the like the will to live, you know? You just have this strong fucking will to completely, to continue the whole night doing workouts and doing that for days and days and days. And the amount of people who are sent to solitary confinement is so great that they don't have cells. They have now queues that you get assigned to the solitary confinement, and then you wait for several weeks before you get into solitary confinement because other people are serving there. And it gets so absurd that some people are getting kicked out from the solitary confinement saying, oh, we need to use it for the other person. You will like sit there in a couple of days when it's free, right? And yeah, it's a very, very stressful place for the body and for the mind. You're not allowed to have any books, anything to write. You're there on your own. You can't use bed. You can use it only for 8 hours from 10 till 6, and then it like claps on the wall. And yeah, that's pretty much it. In many of them, there is no even possibility to sit, so people sit on the floor, and this can be also trouble with the guards. Yes. Then the other part is that Belarusian regime started color labeling prisoners. This didn't start in 2020. This started in 2014. The first prisoners that got color labeled were extremists and also drug-related crimes, different colors. With 2020, we have, I don't know, I think 4 or 5 categories. The main categories are still staying like extremists, and extremists are those who are who were participating in the protests or who were like fighting the regime from 2020. There are, as you were mentioning, thousands of those people. And that means like the color labeling helps the police guards the prison guards to identify who they can, you know, apply extra pressure depending on the prison colonies. You are also supposed to be like always visible to the guards in certain situations. And then in some prison colonies and in some prisons, political prisoners with the yellow badges are not allowed to communicate with each other. But in some prison, it goes even further where like political prisoners are not allowed to talk with the general population, and the general prison population is also not allowed to talk to the political prisoners. So you have places where people are completely isolated from the social group they are living in, it, and they have to live on their own completely. Like, you're just having this mental madness where everybody's afraid to talk to you, because at the end of the day, even like normal prisoners are getting punished with solitary confinement for communication with the political prisoners. Yeah. Yeah. I would start, or yeah. So hold on to your chairs.
Just to wrap it up here, because we have some materials, like we just told you about this protest, right? And what was the consequences of it also for our movement. So we have a stall at the library, the ice rink, at the book fair, and where you can find our zines. So it's like a longer version of analysis of protests, which is available also in French. And also a small zine on repression against anarchists, where you could like look it up what really happened and how it developed, and also two books by anarchist prisoners that have been in prison 5 years ago and now they're back in prison. This is why they cannot be present, for example, today. So it's Igor Alinievich and Mykola Dziadok. They describe their previous prison experiences. So if you want to learn more about like the part about the situations in prison, this is a very good read. Also the hierarchies in prison, the use of different case system, it's really important. So just come over after the talk. I should go? All right, good. So since for some time we have also been including this topic in our presentation because we think this is the most important thing that happens now in our region. And we also think in Europe, but some people doubt that or like want to close their eyes on that. And this is why we would like to like express our own opinion on that, on like how we see war and how we see the political development or how we see political change, if it's possible in this region. And also like some information about how Belarusian society reacted to the war, because you might know that Belarus is part of that war. So it's like, it's an aggressor. It's used for the stationing of the Russian troops, Russian military complex, right now Wagner troops and stuff like that. So, and they launched rockets and they have started invasion in February, also from our territory. So what happened is that you remember that by that time, the protest movement has already been suppressed and it's been like 2 years of repression already. So it was not really surprising that there were not so many massive protests about that or about the war. Many people were just shocked. But also at this, just a few, I think a few weeks or even 1 week after, there was a referendum about changing the constitution to increase Lukashenko's power. And before, many people called to boycott this referendum, to like not go and not even participate in this. But then the opposition leaders and like just general activists said that no, let's go there, let's be in the queues, let's be in the massive like attendance, and not to vote, but just be together and like express our discontent about the war. And this is what happened. So in this day and like a few days after that, people were trying to gather together, standing in the queues, showing some Ukrainian flags and stuff like that. So trying to show the solidarity, and there were some arrests after that. So like at least 1,000 people were detained, were reported to be detained. We don't know how many more in these first days, but it didn't blow up in anything bigger. Like there was no afterwards, there was no massive demonstrations. But also some people, like I said, about 20 groups were reporting to operate on the railway tracks. And in the first weeks of February and March 2022, people were trying to like break the railways. And there were a lot of instructions circulating on the opposition media, on like protest media from bloggers and stuff like that. And so this is what people did, and it was actually quite surprising for me that after 2 years of repression, somebody would like even try to do something like that, knowing that they like immediately end up in jail for like a lot of years. But it looks like there was so much emotion and so much like enragement, let's say, about what was going on. So people started doing it. But the problem was that not only the death penalty was imposed after, but also cops started making ambushes for the, like, in front of different railways, and sometimes they would catch people just before they tried to do something, and they were like shooting them in the knees, like for no reason, because these were not, like, these people were not armed. It's like not that they were like using explosives. It's just you need to like damage a chip, or like you need to like burn a commutator box or something like this. So it's it was a clear image, and of course, like, this picture is from the police channel, so it's like there was a clear message that if you're gonna fuck with us, like, this is what you're gonna get. Okay, now we have like this Prigozhin guy, and like, I think you all follow the story about what happened recently with this like fake coup, or like attempted coup. We don't know how, because this is now in process, right? We don't know how it will end up for Belarus. Just today, we got the news that this guy has started to like talk to our army and like saying that we are going to improve Belarusian army. We're going to like now train, the Wagner is going to like now train the Belarusian army and be stationed there. Yeah, how to cut people's heads off or stuff like that. So this is really fucked up, and like, who knows what these people while they are stationed like will do to Belarusian population, because they're not stationed in the war area, right? They're not in the front. They're like in the middle of our towns, or like traveling and stuff like that. So what's important to say about Lukashenko here is that he has always been this guy who like tried to sit on two chairs, like tried to remain this, or use the advantages of the buffer zone, which Belarus is between the East and the West. So the West was always wanting like to give Belarus some money, some attention, some diplomatic relations, to like in exchange for some liberalization of the political regime, to like provide the buffer zone. Like, no, nobody wanted us in the EU. Like, they actually wanted us to stay in this like limbo, while Russia was like given the same. So it's like many people was always, sometimes we meet people who say, oh, Belarus is like a socialist state. You still have like public healthcare for free, or like public education for free. Yes, we do, like, but still it's, what is that? Okay, the pictures, no pictures. So that's paid by either Russian regime or sometimes European grant programs and stuff like that. So it's not that we have like a third way of that we kind of created a new economic system and stuff like that. And right now, actually, the Belarusian population is quite poor. Like, they don't get more than like 400 bucks per month, and this is usually being spent on food. But we're talking about Lukashenko, so he was like using this to retain his position. And of course, after the war started, there is no fidgeting anymore. So he's trying to like side with the aggressor, but also it's very convenient for Russia to use Belarus and like to have it as a separate country. Like, many people would say like, oh, Russia wants like to control Belarus, or like to absorb it, but actually it's quite inconvenient to just have another country where you can use it like this, a test lab. So you can like introduce some shit there and look how the international community will react on that, and then it will not like touch Russia or vice versa. So like right now there's much more sanctions imposed on Russia than on Belarus, so it's easier to like just use Belarus as a like a hub for importing goods or exporting sanctioned goods and stuff like that. So It's quite a good symbiosis for them. And after like the Prigozhin situation, it looks like we're becoming the second Chechnya, let's say, where basically there is like one guy who's ruling everything, and then he gets like to punish all those who are like rioters, or like kind of an Australia for the UK, where you put all the prisoners, like when you where you send them, and they just under control of another person. And we have seen recently like a lot of fascist treats in our political system, which Lukashenko is promoting. So first of all, it's like the militarization of state institutions. Right now, in many state institutions such as hospitals, universities, even schools, like even small scales or high scales, they're putting not like professional people, not professional like educators or professional doctors, but somebody from the KGB. So it's like the head doctor or like the head of the director of the hospital would be like a guy from the KGB who would overlook the ideological work because they think they fucked up it before. So the protest happened and many people supported it. So how come people in the public institutions do not support the regime? Another thing is that merging the big capital and the state, so basically for a lot of years in Belarus, it's not possible to be a businessman or to enter with the investment if you're not personally loyal to Lukashenko or his family. So it's not like all the big business that we have is completely under his control. And so basically there's no like playing between like, so he's basically the biggest capitalist, let's say. Also fusion of the state and the society, or like the imposed fusion. So it's like, if you're against the state, you don't have the right to be a member of a society, or like putting you out. If you want to like promote this like civil society, you're like an enemy of the state. So there's no like either or, you have to be like one. And yeah, also like state control over culture and media sphere and stuff like that. Which is like, we see this as an increasingly fascist streets, and basically it makes it like even harder, like the means or the methods you need to use against such a regime are also like, we need to like increase the stakes and in thinking about the population that has been already like harassed for so many years, it's highly unlikely that this regime would be like topped by a popular peaceful uprising or something like this.
So other side of the war is that quite a lot of Belarusians that had to leave after 2020 ended up in Ukraine or ended up in Poland. And when the full-scale war broke off, a lot of Belarusians saw Belarus participating in that war and kind of got this notion, okay, we actually have certain responsibility for it. And what they went to fight in Ukraine. Right now, Belarusian diaspora in the war organized groups is one of the biggest. So there are hundreds and hundreds of Belarusians who are fighting the Russian invasion. Many of Belarusians who are fighting there are from the liberal spectrum up to maybe right wing. Some anarchists and anti-fascists are also fighting in Ukraine right now. And in general, yeah, like you have differentiation, or there are a lot of different social and political groups who are fighting from Belarusian side in Ukraine. Unfortunately, most of the groups that are organizing and working together with the Ukrainian military and have like political influence over Belarusian diaspora organizing are from right wing to the extreme right wing. And those groups are for sure trying to turn those fighters in like political capital that can be used later on in their political games, in their like neo-fascist games or whatever. And we see that happens also to the Belarusian society, where influence of the right wing and extreme right wing groups is slowly growing in the Belarusian diaspora as well, because they are the face of that struggle. Even though like hundreds of those people who are fighting are not fascists, the fascists are the ones who are shouting loudest for those people, and they are getting political capital from that. That's what happens with Belarusian volunteer battalions. It's very unfortunate development. Hopefully it will change in the future into something more progressive, but that's what we have right now.
I just wanted to add that throughout the history of this protest and like post-protest movement, Belarusians were always like eager to watch or like observe the riot porn, or like they were like peaceful, but they liked to watch somebody beating up a cop on the media. So it's like kind of not being able to do it yourself, or like not letting yourself do it because you're a polite person or something. But then they liked to somebody else to do it for them. And I think this volunteer battalions are like, right now there is like a very big turn, let's say, in the protest movement against the peaceful methods, because it didn't work. So we need to try something else. But our problem with that is not that people take arms, whatever, but it's more that like these people are getting so much attention and so much power just directed from these peaceful Belarusians to like say, okay, like liberate us as fast as possible. We're going to watch it online, you know, something like that. And then people are like sending them money. People are sharing their posts. And it's not so much about like that there is a battalion. It's more about that the political power that they these battalions are getting without actually any credit or any... a responsibility or like commitment to special, like even democratic future for the Belarus that they're liberating. This is very problematic. And like we in Warsaw group, in the Warsaw anarchist group, in the diaspora, we're trying to like talk about that and about like seeing violence as a tool, but not like relegating violence to somebody else who is like more brave.
But I would disagree in the moment where that they are not doing anything. They are doing quite a fucking a lot, like the people who are fighting, and like, right. As I was mentioning, like the political power is shifting to the right inside of the Belarusian opposition, and we can see that also inside of the, let's say, so-called leaders of the Belarusian opposition. Those are changing quite dramatically to more people who have, let's say, history of violence or something like that, but also people who have their foot inside of the Belarusian regime. On this slide, for example, the person on the left, is like a former diplomat of Belarusian state in France. The next person is a chief of one of the departments of the political police who was repressing people in 2020 and then jumped the boat in hope that Belarusian regime will collapse. And he's still hoping that he will become like a head of the ministry, Ministry of Internal Affairs. And like the guy on the right, for example, the bold one, he is now like a head of the military inside of the Belarusian opposition. He is a former military of the Belarusian regime. Right? And that's kind of like a shift that is very dangerous because the discussion is shifting from that perspective of, okay, we need a country that has like a decentralized power, that has mechanisms that will never make Lukashenko possible again. Like, we don't need a fucking president. We need to create it in a different way. Again, to the like, oh, we need to make it strong. We need a strong hand that will, you know, get us together and liberate us. And this is again happening from the same corner of the people who are not, let's say, even liberals. Many of them are like conservative up to the extreme right, who would be up for another dictatorship most probably, but in a different setup. So they would be like, you know, the people in power and not some other guy who is wearing leather jacket talking about Lukashenko. Yeah. In general, talking about war, I think it's important to mention again and again that war is a horrible thing. Like, it's destroys everything that we were fighting for, and it destroys so many lives and so many communities around Ukraine right now that there is no fucking way anybody's cheering war. I mean, we were blamed quite a lot for being warmongers and the people who are like fighting, like who are promoting war. We are not. We are fucking hating this war, and most probably more than most of you here in this room, because there are a lot of prices that were paid in the last year. But at the same time, we see this war as a moment of a political social turmoil that is going to change the way the region is looking for generations to come. And if you are denying that, you are a fool, basically, from my perspective. And for us as anarchists, it is very important to participate in that situation in different ways. Some anarchists prefer to participate in like humanitarian initiatives. The others are taking weapons and fighting back. But we find ourselves in the situation where we do not have moral right to escape, or many of us do not have a moral right, or how would you say, do not find ourselves in the situation where we can just leave the population and be the people who are deserting for the safety of few. And in that case, like that's why we have a lot of people who are fighting. We also have a lot of people who we lost in the last year. And this struggle for us is also a political struggle for the space that will happen after the war, the political changes that will be happening in Ukraine, that will be happening in Russia, in Belarus after the war. Because for us, if this war is lost and Putin wins with Lukashenko, there will be no political struggle for generations to come in Russia, in Ukraine, in Belarus, because they were killing people, they were killing political opposition before the war, they are killing people during the war, and there is nothing to indicate that the killing will stop when they win or they get peace. And for us, the struggle is also about conquering space, be present in the military, be present in the humanitarian space, to stand together, not with the generals or officers or even like the government state, but rather to be present with the people who are struggling, the people of, I don't know, Krematorsk, people who are there on the front lines, maybe not military, just the simple people. They see anarchists as part of the struggle against the violence of the state. The pure violence of the state that Russia brought to the Ukrainian territory that kills people in hundreds of thousands, and this violence can be stopped only with like self-defense that will be violent. And we hope that the fucking regimes will fall and there will be no need for this brutal and bloody conflict.
I just wanted to hear, like, is a good moment to advertise another brochure, which has the position of ABC Belarus and also the position of the Belarusian Anarchist in Exile in Warsaw that I'm also part of. So it's in English and also Spanish, Italian, Greek, and French, I think. So you can find it in our stall. But I think it's important to mention that the war will stop tomorrow. If Putin withdraws his troops, it's like it will stop tomorrow. So, and this is why we see three different directions that we need to support as Belarusian diaspora, like in exile, is basically first do support every movement or all the that our comrades are doing in Russia instead to like prevent their troops from advancing or like destroy the mobilization campaigns and stuff like that. Second is to prevent Belarus to join war, like en masse, to work on projects or to work with the social groups that could be potentially mobilized. And so basically really like sometimes even getting people out, which would be important because they would be the invaders. They would not be the ones who would be fighting back. And third, supporting and like accepting the full agency and subjectivity of our Ukrainian comrades, because we don't want to judge, like we're not there, we're not dying, our families are not dying, and we will not judge them saying that, okay, this is a delusion, you need to be like anti-militarist to be like pure and stuff like that. So if they want to run, we accept them in Warsaw. If they want to fight, we send them our support. So this is the three most important things that we would like to work on, and it doesn't exclude one or the other. So because many times you like Boris said, like we are seen as people who like to like play the war. No, we like to analyze it from the perspective of our region and how our political struggle will look like, or if we're even being able to remain anarchist, or we just have to merge and become German anarchist or Polish anarchist and stuff like that.
And this is like a very small space to talk about this topic, not in the room, but in general, the time we have. But there will be like today also a talk anti-authoritarian perspectives on the war in Ukraine, in also here, but in the smaller room in the evening. There will be also two talks on Saturday. One will be like a panel discussion with different solidarity groups from Ukraine, Russia, Belarus, talking about the war, and there will be also presentation from solidarity collectives in ZAF in the evening on Saturday. Feel free to visit those. There will be a lot of I think accusations and shit on our shoulders thrown in the next days, but at the same time for us it's very important that you join those events, because those events are where we get a little bit closer to the reality than what people from different countries try to present. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Thanks for the applause. for you. All right. Thank you. Thank you. We just have like five more minutes of your attention, please. Like we would just wrap it up. Coming back to. No. They were just hailing us. Right. So just a little bit about like anarchists in Belarus? Question mark. Other, right? So of course. At least 30 plus people, like the biggest group that you can imagine, they are behind bars. Here you can see like a poster that we're also handing out, trying to like spread it all over the place. Where you, if you're coming from somewhere and you can put it somewhere, please come and take a few of them. We're listing them, and they right now there is not all of these people have been tried, so there's nothing, no case that is ongoing right now. But at the same time, it's been very hard to support people because they need money all the time, even though they don't have so much care packages or visits. People usually need like 300 to 500 euros per month to an every person. So, and we are not able to provide them all of it. And we like, our belief is that families should not take the responsibility for the struggle of the activists, because if we're like announcing that we are like an international anarchist community that acts in solidarity, that we should like actually prove it and not like say, okay, like you have a family, fuck you. Then there is us. Okay, we're not in Belarus anymore. We are scattered in the different places right now. Allegedly, yes. So we still are trying to work on this repression, and we are very tired, actually. And it doesn't look very bright because the movement, the Belarusian movement that used to be quite supportive of the ABC struggles and structures in Belarus, because all of us felt that it was, we need this structure for us, because the next time they come for us, we need, there is someone who will like take care of us. But with the fact that many people moved out, so they now live like, nobody is like chasing them anymore in the new country that they're living, so there is no need for like for us as a structure. But also there is like people are shifting. I don't know, the expiration date of anarchists are like dwindling, like, you know, 3-4 years, somebody in the movement then moving out. So, and it's like more and more people stopped like being active or just move on with their lives, leaving us with all those people who are like there for 20 years. So I don't imagine myself staying on this stage for 20 more years and like trying to still do something for my comrades. So, and we also don't like that the recently, because of so much work, we were changed into more or less like a crowdfunding collective instead of a political collective that could produce, I don't know, security culture or like political analysis and stuff. So we don't like our position right now, but unfortunately we have to do it. And like, this is why we're like asking for your support every time we see you. There is a promen.io website and the media collective behind it. So these people are trying to create some content still and work with the protest or post-protest readers, create this opportunities for people to see that there is like another way of looking at things, not only the like representative democracy. And they have like an extensive English version where you could also, I think in the future, download all these like PDFs that we are translating and trying to distribute. Yeah, like I told you, there is a group of Belarusian anarchists in Warsaw in exile which tries to work with the diaspora, because a lot of people moved to Poland, to Warsaw, from the Belarusian activists. So we are trying to organize like anarchist events or try to like promote anarchism in these circles or promote anarchist practices, I would say, because we think that it's important that when or if we are coming back, it's good that we have as many sympathizers or allies as possible when there will be like a struggle of who will take the power after. Right, and so just a few faces, which you will find also on this poster. So you can see, some of you can see the number of years that these people got. And like, for example, one of these people, like, for example, Anastasia Kuchta, who is down on the, she got like 5 years for being active in a neighborhood assembly. And she got 5 years for being like an extremist and like calling for sanctions and harming the national security and stuff like that. Her mother just died of cancer recently. And of course, she was not let to see her or to attend this funeral. The Pramen case, you remember I told about Pramen Media Collective, right? So it's a website, and it has been announced, declared extremist. So these people who were participating or allegedly participating in a protest and allegedly were spreading leaflets and also holding a banner with a link to that website. So it was enough to put them behind bars for 5 years. You have probably heard about the case of anarcho-partisans. So it's like four people who crossed illegally from Ukraine. So they're like Belarusian anarchists, but they crossed from Ukraine illegally. They had some arms, explosives and stuff. And they started doing some attacks, setting cops' car on fire or like burning the judiciary buildings and stuff like that. Unfortunately, on the way back to Ukraine, they got caught on a very stupid reason, because somebody reported strange people in the forest. So they all got 20 years, or like more or less 18 to 20 years, and now they have been transferred to these high security prisons. So they like a lot of pressure on these guys. And also these 10 people here are under the same case of anarchist criminal organization, which is Revolutionary Action, like we had this organization before the protest. And I think the cops used the protest as a pretext to just speculate or like persecute them for everything that they have done in 8 years before. So it's like not that they are like, they have not been necessarily charged with protests, participating in protests, but also all the previous actions that this group took a responsibility for. And also, like, these four people is like some anti-fascists from the former Antifa football club supporters. So, of course, many of these people actually, like, maybe many former hooligans, both right-wing and left-wing, joined the protest because it was, like, cool and riots and stuff. So, but also because all of them had like something that the rest of the population didn't have, is the practice of collective action, right? So this is why you can go as a gang, and like you, of course, you feel more more strong, more forceful, and stuff like that, and you know, like you can rely on your comrade. So this is what probably they were doing, and they were like pepper spraying cops in the undercover cars and stuff like that. So unfortunately, they used phones. Talk to each other about that, and like, so they got 5 to 6 years in prison right now.
Yeah. And I think for me, this is a very fast run through the couple of stories, right? Every person from that list has their own personal story of life struggle, continuation of struggle in the prison. Some of those stories we try to collect, and we publish it actually on our website. So if you're interested in our comrades and what are they about, you can get that information. Partly it's translated into English, partly it's not, because, yeah, it's not translated. It takes time to translate things. And that's the last slide. So we almost reached the end. The general reason why we are doing these talks is, or one of the main reasons, or one of the biggest reasons, is we are collecting money. And as you were mentioning, some comrades are sitting in prison for a very long time. We are not the people with a lot of money. Belarusians are also not the people with a lot of money, who are mostly struggling economically. So we rely heavily, actually, on the money solidarity from the comrades from the West. And that's a very important part for us, that you actually donate to ABC Belarus. We have like a QR code. We are also present in the at the book fair, where you can buy our merch and stuff and so on. We are also present here. We just squatted like a corner with our t-shirts. So if you're leaving the room, you can also just donate money or buy some shirts and, you know, consume. That's what people in the West do, right? That I was told in the school. Yeah, so donations are very important, and not only like one-time donations, but rather we have this program that is called like a prisoner supporter, where you can or you should talk to your comrades, like to your groups maybe, and think about long-lasting donations that you can drop into solidarity, because every person that is right now in prison have different needs, but on the average it's like, I don't know, 400, 500 euro that have to be spent on the monthly basis. Multiply that by the amount of people and you understand that those money are like not going to get out of thin air, and we can't print those money. Though there will be talks, I think, about that, how to do this. But in general, like we can't do this, and we rely on you to show initiative in solidarity. We can only mobilize you, but it's your actions. It's actions of your groups. So you can become a supporter of one of those people. And this will actually help a lot, not only like our work, but it will help a lot the struggle of the people inside of the prisons. Spread the word. A lot of the things that we are talking about are very, like, how would you say, compressed. As we were mentioning, there are a bunch of brochures we brought. We brought books. We didn't bring that for ourselves. We brought that for you to pass you information that we know, that we kind of like objectively somehow got into. That information you can get at the book fair. Also, be like fucking curious. For me, being an anarchist is also part of this kind of a, maybe a little bit of a stressful modus, but also modus where you try to learn the things. It's not like you go to one website, you read one article, and you know how the fucking world works, right? That's not an anarchist perspective on the world, but rather like you have to constantly try to understand, reassess how the things are, and so on and so forth. And this is very important in the situation in Belarus, because we got in 2020 some bullshit like Belarus is a socialist state, but also it's very important right now when the war is like raging through the region, because there is a lot of disinformation, and we learned that anarchist movement is not immune to disinformation. So you have to understand that there is disinformation, and it's coming also sometimes from the corners that we wouldn't expect. And maybe it's on purpose sometimes, sometimes it's not on purpose. So be critical and be curious and be fucking vigilant in this struggle, in this fucking age of information where you have to navigate through those information streams way more and spread more, spend more efforts into that. So don't fucking watch Russia Today and unfollow this shit on the social networks, even though they're providing good riot porn. This is not the point, but rather like the point is to get information that will affect your political decisions, that will make you like a sharp revolutionary instead of like just a consumer of social networks or tweets or whatever shit. Send letters to the people in prison. And that means you can send it via online form, as I was talking about, or you can go to the book fair and pass us the letters that you want. We also have postcards that you can sign and pass it to the, we will pass it to the comrades. This is also not a huge work that required from you, but this is like a fucking minimum I expect from every person. And I remembered your faces, so if you don't subscribe, sign the postcard, I will catch you and make you a sign. I grew up in dictatorship, right? This is my character, so. Right. So I think like the last part, and it's, I think the last part to make an accent on is that we are not here to ask for your pity, and you would be like, oh, look at these pure Belarusians. They are like suffering their whole fucking life and live and die in suffering. But rather we are anarchists. We are like revolutionary people who are struggling. We believe in freedom. We believe in society of equals. We are not eternal victims. We are struggling here. This fucking presentation is a struggle for us. We, as you were mentioning, Masha, we are fucking tired, right? The struggle is also of the people who are in prison. The people are not waiting for your, you know, like, pity and, I don't know, tears or whatever, but rather this is a struggle and that requires your solidarity. It requires your sharpness. It requires your connection, right? And for us, it is also the struggle that is happening right now in Ukraine, where we lost some comrades. And this was like, you know, we had a great year in 2020 where we were believing that we will breathe the freedom, you know, And we had a horrible fucking 3 years. It was a fucking horrible nightmare. And this nightmare continues. And through this nightmare, we actually find ourselves as revolutionaries. We do not find ourselves as victims of the war. We find ourselves as the fighters of the war. Of the war that we fight against the Belarusian state, against the Russian state, against every fucking state, against capitalism. We are the revolutionaries, and I hope that you are also in this room and in this fucking city, all the people that are coming. We are actually urging you to be revolutionary anarchists and show your solidarity not only with Belarusians, but with all those who are requiring that. Thank you very much.
Hey people, thanks for being here. We know it's been a fight for you to stay in this hot room, right? So thanks a lot for your attention. So we have some minutes, I think we need to they need to prepare also for the next one. So let's say like 20 minutes max. Doesn't mean that we need to stay here, but like let's collect some of the comments and hands. And I suggest that we do like 1, 2, 3 hands, and then we like reply, not replying to each of you. Okay, so can we see like hands? I see 1, 2, 3, and 4. Is there a microphone that people need to use to be heard? Okay, so we will have someone running around and passing.
Thank you. My question is about death sentence. You talked about the extension of death sentence on attempted terrorism. Do you know whether this is only a threat or whether there are already trials, verdicts, or even people executed for attempted terrorism? What can you tell me about that?
Hi, I'm from Brazil, so thanks for sharing. There's no information about Belarus there. I'm a geography teacher, and a few months ago, I presented to my students some video from footnote bombs on Belarus during 2014, I guess. And as you said on presentation, there are a lot of punish to those solidarity groups, and as you are from ABC, do you know if it still occurs, footnote bombs, and how it's during this context of war? So that's it. Thanks.
I've been interested in what you said. I've been interested in what you said about activists on exile and like organizing within the diaspora, and maybe you could explain more how it works, and do you cooperate between diasporas in different countries, and do you cooperate with non-anarchist like refugees, I should say, or diasporas, like people in diaspora?
I can talk about footnote bombs. The footnote bombs doesn't exist anymore in Belarus. It stopped, I think, in 2021. So the people were continuing even when repressions were going quite hard. And then I think it was summer 2021 when they decided to stop it. Because, yeah, the possibilities of getting arrested were raised, and a lot of people left the country at that point. So it's not happening. I mean, it was working in very weird situations, in like very harsh repression situations, even during COVID when most of the events were like not happening. But yeah, now it's not there. I think there was even like a text in English published about food not bombs stopping being active in Belarus. And there is somewhere around the same time there was an interview published with the Belarusian food not bombs and their participation and perspectives on the protest.
But cool, thanks for it's so nice. So hope your kids are having a good grasp of our country. All right, death sentences, right? So this is already real. It's not like that the law is being planned to be passed. It is passed, but the problem is that some of the groups that have been on this trial have not been sentenced yet. So we don't know what they will apply. I know at least of two groups that were sentenced and they got like 20 something years, so that it wasn't death sentence but 20 years. So let's see how it goes. Maybe it was used just for like stopping people and they will not like go so crazy, but we don't know, right? And organizing in the diaspora. So when people move, like lived in the Belarus, some of us tried to concentrate in a specific cities, let's say, and I think mostly people are living in Poland, Lithuania, some of them in Georgia, which makes it quite hard to like cooperate on this level, like to do collective actions, for example. So I think the Warsaw group is the only group that is organized and exists as like a name and doing something in this respect. And we are mostly a city-based. So we're trying to like talk sometimes to people who live in another cities, but it's not going super productive, let's say. So what we were doing is like because also the problem, or like maybe not the problem, but the good thing was also that we as anarchists got a lot of attention after the protest and a lot of like positive attention. So people like. We, as ABC Belarus, got donations from, like, normal people, which never happened, because everybody likes anarchists and everybody likes what they said, or, like, people were reading these books, and also one of them was, like, a blogger who was mostly, like, providing political analysis and stuff like that. So people knew anarchists, and we thought that it's very important to now, like, grasp it and not, like, just go back to our sect, let's say, and try to be like, if people want to listen to us, we would like to kind of talk to them. So this is what we were trying to do. But at the same time, because the group is not so big, because there's not so much, like, for example, public speaking skills, not all of us have it, or like training skills, like providing education in, I don't know, anarchist practices, like horizontal organizing or something like this, or like assemblies in a non-hierarchical way. So we were like, basically right now we are trying to be part of the local protest group that meets every Sunday for like a small protest of Belarusians, and we have like someone there who is inside this assembly, like trying to influence the decisions and trying to like sometimes transfer our ideas or like our agenda inside. But also mostly we're doing the educational projects or like talks on anti-authoritarianism or how Belarus could look like. Alternatively, we have organized also a school of anarchism, which lasted for half a year. Every 2 weeks, we provided like a new talk about like anarchism and democracy, anarchism and capitalism. So it's like just basically explaining people what it means to be an anarchist. And we created like a core group of people who would like always go, because also in Warsaw, we most probably are the only ones who are providing like kind of intellectual content, because mostly Belarusian diaspora is providing like cultural events, things for kids, learning Belarusian language together. So it's like not so many people are like offering content where you could like discuss social or political issues. And so recently we made like a big two-day festival against dictatorship, and it was like quite well attended, taking into account that we only like provided in Russian. There was no Polish people there. So, yeah, and basically we're like grateful to like local anarchists who like provide us with infrastructure, like we could use the spaces, and because the Belarusian NGOs that organized in Warsaw, they don't like to host us so much in their spaces, because they say we are against any party
So it's like they're not providing any the spaces to parties, right? Because they will like promote their agenda. And it's so funny that they see us as parties. So the people who are like for fucking 10 years promoting the horizontal organizing and not saying that, no, we don't want the power. Now they see us as a political force that wants to like intrude or like put something on top of people. So it's a bit complicated to get inside these spaces because of the like under carpet struggle against us, but from the liberals. So yeah, and also recently, I think one of the projects was also creating a podcast in Russian about war, and where I interviewed like 8 people from different countries. And I mean, not like Russian speaking people who are like Russians or Belarusians or Ukrainians, but more like a French person who speaks Russian, right? Who can like explain what people in France think or what anarchists in France think. Because in the problem is that in this Eastern Slavic, let's say, world, many people don't speak English. Like many people don't get how you guys react to war and why and what are your discourses here. So I tried to like provide this like Russian for the Russian speakers, this content that people kind of have to be able to create this international connection, because it's kind of broken, I think. Yeah, so that's what we have been doing. Sorry for being so long. Okay, a few more hands, if there are any. 1, 2. Okay, for now, 2 then.
Yeah, my question would be if there's any collaboration between Polish secret service and Belarusian secret service in suppressing, like, your work in Warsaw.
Est-ce que c'est possible d'avoir une traduction vers l'anglais? Ouais, ok. Ouais, du coup, bah merci pour la présentation. En tout cas, moi, il y a plusieurs trucs qui m'ont fait bizarre dans votre présentation. C'est bon? Ok. En tout cas, tu as conclu par dire que tu étais contre l'État russe et contre l'État. C'est bon, ouais. Contre l'État biélorusse. Bah, moi, je suis aussi contre l'État ukrainien et contre l'OTAN et contre toutes les formes d'État. Et en tout cas, ça me fait bizarre d'arrêter le raisonnement là. Ah oui, pardon. Oui.
So, he said. Can you hear me or not? The thing is, I don't think people can hear me when I speak in here. Huh? I don't think people can hear when I speak in here.
Yeah, they just need to get radio. Huh? It's too. That's
Well, thank you very much for taking your presentation. And I've heard that you said you were against the Russian and Belarusian state, but his opinion is that he's also against the Ukrainian state. And I think that's about as far as we got. Tu peux continuer.
Et qu'en tout cas, pour moi, rejoindre l'armée, c'est pas une forme de lutte, ou c'est pas une perspective politique pour moi. Surtout si je me dis anti-autoritaire, pour moi, l'armée, c'est une des institutions les plus autoritaires qui existent dans ce monde. Et du coup, ça me fait un peu bizarre, en tout cas, que ça soit, surtout dans des rencontres anti-autoritaires, que ça soit porté comme une perspective de lutte, de rejoindre l'armée ou de rejoindre des bataillons de volontaires, mais qui au final sont supervisés par l'armée ukrainienne. Et du coup, voilà, c'est juste une remarque comme ça. Moi, je pense que c'est pas du tout mes perspectives. Et du coup, ça me fait bizarre d'entendre ça dans des rencontres anti-autoritaires.
Ouais. I was wondering about the status of the feminist movement. You said there was quite a strong feminist organization in Belarus, and I'm wondering whether they stayed and were able to remain active, or whether they moved out, or like what was the story afterwards? I didn't really catch that. Thank you.
Je vais pas répondre en français, je vais répondre en anglais, mais j'espère que tu comprendras. I'll respond in English to, I would like to add, this is something I wanted to add even before the question, my perspective as a Russian who supports Ukraine and who supports Belarusian opposition movements. I agree 100% with what my comrade said today on the stage. I live in France, and this sort of perspective where you say, I don't understand why you're not against all sides, I hate NATO, etc. I'm sorry, it's very hard not to be angry about this, because it's really fucking tiring for the last 500 days. You can hate NATO, you can hate all states, you can hate Zelensky if you want, but when there is a real war happening with real guns and real people dying every day, you need to wake the fuck up, okay? I'm really sorry about this, you know. There is only one way for peace to happen, and that is for Russia to withdraw its troops, like my comrade said. There is only one way for this to end, in a way that's acceptable to us. It's to prevent the invasion of a country, the killing of civilian citizens. And this is, like, people have a very hard time in Western Europe because they're very used to relativism and critical thought, which is a great thing. You know, I'm for relativism and critical thought. But at some point, it erases some very fundamental truths and realities, okay? When a country goes and even forget the idea of country, when people with power go and invade another territory, they are killing civilians every day, they are killing people who never wanted to be soldiers but who have to become soldiers to defend their families, their communities. You know, they might hate the state as well, they might not like NATO or Zelensky, who cares? They have to defend themselves today, okay? So when you sit there with your abstract thoughts and you say, like, oh, but it's all a NATO conspiracy, sorry, if you start saying that, oh, this is a conspiracy and I hate all states, I don't want to get my hands dirty, I don't want to pick a side. For us, this is just, you know, for people who actually understand that this is a real war happening every day, it just, yeah. I don't know how to describe this emotion, but it's very counterproductive. No matter if you're an anarchist, no matter if you're Ukrainian, Russian, Belarusian, or anything else, it's not, I don't think it's useful. You can continue to criticize the state, of course, we are here for this. You can continue to criticize every side, but it is definitely, I think, 100% okay to be an anarchist and to engage in active fighting here, because Ukrainians can't just lie down with a bouquet of flowers in front of a tank, okay? They need weapons. They need to defend themselves against a dictatorship that is trying to kill them all. That's it.
Okay, thank you for this comment. I will answer the two, the security and the feminist question. So, for now, we have not, like, studied it, how much, how deep they are going together. Like, at least I think the Belarusian and the Polish are not cooperating on any level that is, like, exchanging information about us, because I think right now they have cut their connections. For example, previously it happened with Ukrainian and Belarusian, even though, like, right now, like, also the Ukrainian politicians are, like, saying, oh, like, we're so, like, kind of, they opened their eyes to fucking dictatorship that they were trading with for all these years, that they didn't care about all these years, and now they're, like, saying, okay, like, look, now we are only now we are cutting ties, you know, like, when it's about our interests. And I also don't, so Ukraine didn't join any fucking sanctions before, so when connected to the protests. So I think it's important to say that they were collaborating before, Ukraine and Belarusian, and this is why a few of Belarusian comrades were actually expelled from Ukraine just before the war, because the local Ukrainian social security service didn't like them. But for the Polish one, what they're doing right now is they're, like, actively trying to look for spy groups. So
usually the spy groups are like Russian, Belarusian, or Ukrainians who are pro-Russian, and they have caught a few already. And so this is why they're trying to like look for people who have migrant roots, who like speak Russian or who can like be under Russian influence, and figure out how they can like infiltrate them or like talk to them. So a few of our comrades who received refugee status or international protection status got a call from the Polish security service saying, why don't you come over to talk about your migrant experience and stuff like that. And so as soon as you come with a lawyer, they don't want to talk to you. And it's clearly that they're like trying to understand the network, you know, like the connections, who you are siding with. So this is happening. And I think for us, okay, on the one hand, we got this like protection or like refugee statuses, but that's also something that they can always take, you know. So I mean, the refugee status, I don't think so, but many Belarusians get the international protection, meaning that as soon as there is like no danger, you have to fuck off. So, and this is why I think a lot of people are actually afraid to get too much trouble in Poland, like as Belarusian anarchists, because we don't have like a way to go back. So so it's quite problematic. Right. So the feminist movement, Boris was saying, that there was a lot of like women organized protests and also women organized chats or like projects during the protest. And many of them, like I know a few people who have been admins of such chats, like some women who like had to run away because they were already targeted, because all of these chats were like public. So cops could just scan who was there and like started to take these people. And right now what's happening is that the feminists are trying to organize with each other, because there is different kinds of feminist groups. So some of them are like more socialist, let's say, or like leftist, others with just liberal and wanting a female, I don't know, president or something like this. So there is like an internal conversation between them, but also in this government in exile, there is a special coordination council that is formed where everybody can apply and join it. So it's like quite kind of horizontal. It's like open to everyone. I don't know if anarchists are going to join it in the end, but there was this idea to like just check it out. And I know that there is like a fraction, that is called gender like faction or something like this, that who tries to promote or influence the politicians, the opposition politicians, because they are getting like very masculine, like, you know, like getting more guys inside the government and stuff like that. So this is what they were doing, or like struggling with like misogyny in the independent media. So it's like nowadays, like everybody's trying to work with this kind of diaspora. So people are trying to influence the protesters, the former protesters, to like become actually fucking democratic, right? Not just think that, okay, like now we just change the president, is gonna be cool. So yeah, I think that this is, at least this is how I see from the side. I'm not part of any feminist group right now, and so I cannot like talk deeper on that.
And I will add a couple of words to the comrade from Russia. Unfortunately, the person opposing Ukraine, like the whatever, the world was weird, is gone. Let's make it fucking clear. We are not for Ukrainian state. But it is very weird that it is expected from us that we are stating our opposition to the Ukrainian state. For me, that means we have to state opposition to Swiss state, because we are in Switzerland, maybe around the states that we passed to come to Switzerland. And this is just a fucking bullshit. Like, I think it's important in anarchist movement to be able to call bullshit, and it is bullshit. We as anarchists oppose the Ukrainian state, okay? We oppose the Russian state. We oppose the Belarusian state. I hope that would be fucking enough, right? But it's not, because the world is a weird place. I'm sitting in front of you in fucking Switzerland while a comrade of ours is sitting next to a mortar and tries to survive in the fucking trenches. It is a weird world. You have to get used to it. If you're not living in the European Union or in Switzerland, the world is fucking weird. Just open the doors and open the eyes and wake the fuck up, right? And that's an essential part to understand on your road to revolution, that the revolution is not done in a very simple, nice world where everything is clear and we are kind of marching towards the bright fucking future. No. At the same time, as anarchists, for us, the way towards revolution is very important, and the compromises we make are not the compromises that are destroying our political ideas. And this is also, like, let it fucking sink, that the people that, who are fighting with their weapons, who are fighting with AKs, who are fighting with fucking mortars, they are anarchists. They are not there to, you know, protect Zelensky or protect Ukrainian state or shit like that. They are there to protect their lives, because they were running their whole fucking life. They're there to protect the lives of their neighbors, to protect the lives of their communities. And it is a very fucking weird world in which anarchists are actually calling people to lay down their weapons and die in peace. I don't want to die in peace. And I... I don't want to die in peace, and I will never fucking tell anybody else to die in peace and die in fucking torture and whatever shit is coming with the Russian world. So please take that in your account when you're saying such a bullshit that, oh, you didn't say this word, you didn't say this word, and that just becoming a fucking justification of you being ignorant, arrogant fuck. I'm very sorry to the comrade, but it is like that for me, who just wants to make a point that doesn't have anything to do with the reality. You know, just to make a smart comment that will, you know, you throw into the crowd and then you don't even bother to wait for an answer for the from the people who you asked to. I think we are done for now. We will meet at some point in the coming future. I would like to remember that we have the shirts. Thanks a lot for coming. Thanks a lot for translation and for whole Orga crew. They did a great work. And don't forget the struggles that are happening outside of a comfort zone of Switzerland, please. Thank you.
Thank you about this really intense discussion. Now, on a more trivial